The summer of 1974 sits heavy over Boston, like a wet blanket nobody can kick off. Mary Pat Fennessy wakes in her Commonwealth Housing Project apartment to another sweltering morning, the brick walls trapping heat like an oven set on slow roast. She's a single mother working 12-hour shifts at a nursing home, her hands permanently rough from lifting patients and changing sheets. Across the breakfast table, her 17-year-old daughter Jules picks at day-old bread, her tough girl facade cracking as she talks about being forced to attend school in Roxbury, what everyone in South Boston calls dangerous territory. When Jules doesn't come home that night, Mary Pat's world fractures. But this isn't just a story about one missing girl. It's about how an entire city's racial hatred, wrapped in the language of neighborhood loyalty and school choice, creates the conditions where children vanish and everyone pretends not to notice. What makes someone racist? Mary Pat would bristle at the label. She considers herself one of the good ones, who judges people by character, not color. Yet she casually distinguishes between hard-working Black people and those she considers lazy. At work, she takes pride in treating all patients equally, yet unconsciously counts the ratio of white to Black residents in each wing. When a new Black nurse joins the staff, Mary Pat makes a point of being friendly, but also finds herself mentally noting that this one is different, articulate, well-spoken. She doesn't hear the insult embedded in her own compliment. This contradiction, believing you're fair while harboring deep prejudice, captures something essential about how racism actually operates. It's not always burning crosses and slurs. More often, it's the thousand small calculations we make without thinking, the mental categories we inherit, like furniture from previous generations. We arrange our worldview around these inherited assumptions, never questioning whether they belong to us at all. Southie itself functions as a character in this story, a tight-knit neighborhood where everyone knows everyone's business across three or four generations. The regulars at Shaughnessy's Bar trade the same stories they've been telling for decades, each claiming their piece of neighborhood mythology. Tommy Doyle still recounts the night he and his brother fought off three guys from Dorchester. Mrs. Hennessy reminds everyone she was crowned Miss Southie in 1952. These stories become scripture, repeated until they calcify into identity. Crossing into another neighborhood feels like crossing into enemy territory. This insularity creates genuine warmth. Neighbors shoveling each other's walks, gathering on stoops in summer, passing down baby clothes through extended families, but also breeds suspicion of outsiders that curdles into something darker. The same loyalty that makes Southie feel like family also makes it a fortress. When Mary Pat assembles anti-busing protest signs reading "Protect Our Children" and "Neighborhood Schools for Neighborhood Kids," her hands shake slightly. She doesn't think of herself as defending segregation. She thinks she's protecting her daughter from danger, from the unknown, from change itself. That's how it always works. We wrap our prejudices in the language of love and safety, transforming fear into virtue, exclusion into protection. In Mary Pat's world, fighting isn't aberrant behavior. It's the basic grammar of communication, the lingua franca of survival. Her earliest memory involves attacking a 6-year-old boy who splashed her doll, a seemingly trivial incident that established a pattern she'd repeat throughout her life. By 6th grade, she'd been in at least 20 fights outside her home, and inside was worse. 5 brothers in constant territorial warfare, a mother who disciplined with wooden spoons that left welts, a father wielding his belt with brutal efficiency and no remorse. This normalized violence defines the entire community, where reputation is earned through fists and respect flows from the willingness to throw the first punch. When Mary Pat can't find Jules, her maternal instinct transforms into something primal and unstoppable. She breaks Rum Collins's nose at Marty Butler's bar, blood spraying across the counter, continuing her assault with single-minded fury until several men pull her off. Later, confronting the Swab sisters, Southie women against busing who turn against her, she unleashes years of project fighting skills, punching, scratching, biting, hair pulling, leaving several women bloodied on the pavement while remaining standing herself, barely winded. Violence isn't just her last resort, it's her first language, the only dialect she trusts when words fail. Then there's Augustus Williamson, a 20-year-old Black man found dead with multiple head traumas at Columbia Station. Many Southie residents dismiss him as a drug dealer who shouldn't have been in their part of town, their prejudices providing convenient absolution. Except Augie wasn't a drug dealer. He was a high school graduate in a management trainee program at a downtown bank, someone's beloved son with dreams of advancement, a young man who rode the train to work each morning in pressed slacks and polished shoes. This revelation shatters Mary Pat's comfortable assumptions about who deserves protection and justice, forcing her to confront the arbitrary nature of her tribal loyalties. The same fierce loyalty that makes neighbors shovel walks in winter can also make them complicit in murder.